Blog Talk Radio.
Did you know there's a secret place to expand your mind? A place to escape the same old negative news? Welcome to Colombo Chronicles Live with Rose Colombo, award-winning author, cable TV and radio host, poet, and advocate for justice. Rose has been seen and heard on local and national TV and radio. She's consulted with victims of injustice for more than 20 years. Her articles have been published in major and local newspapers and magazines. Listen live as Rose Colombo welcomes prominent authors and experts to her podcast every Wednesday from noon to 1 p.m. Pacific time at blogtalkradio.com/Colombo Chronicles. You can call in and ask questions at 646-564-9742. Follow Rose Colombo every Wednesday from 12 noon to 1 p.m. on Colombo Chronicles Live at blogtalkradio.com/Colombo Chronicles.
Hi, everyone. This is the Rose Colombo, right here for you every Wednesday from 12 to 1 p.m., God willing.
Colombo Chronicles Live. Colombo is on their trail. Listen up at Colombo Chronicles Live.
That's right. We're live. Thank God we're 6 feet above the ground so far. And it's another beautiful day on the West Coast, and the birds are happy and chirping. But, of course, that isn't happening everywhere. Although, I hope it is happening for you wherever you live. You know, it is a beautiful world, but not for everyone. But today we have a really dynamic guest, and he's a returning guest. His name is Preston Rendell. You probably have heard of Preston Rendell. He's a former Mr. USA and a second place winner of Mr. Universe. He is a health expert and author. And I'll tell you a little more about Preston Rendell and his book, Room Full of Killers, in just a few minutes. First, I want to talk about the issues of the day. And one of the issues of the day that I felt was important was an issue involving Senator Dianne Feinstein. We don't hear much about Senator Dianne Feinstein, and she's been in public office in the Senate and Congress for about 25 years or more, maybe 26. And she was the mayor of San Francisco at one time. But there is an important article I think we should all know about, and you may not come across. It is called, Will We Ever Know What the Chinese Learned from the Senator? And it is published and posted by Newt Gingrich. And it reads like this, published January 18th, 2019. Dave Pruss, PRUS, posted this article, Will We Ever Know What the Chinese Learned from the Senator? Let's look at a case study in Justice Department and news media bias. The treatment of President Donald J. Trump compared with the treatment of Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein. The media's glee over news that a group of anti-Trump bureaucrats took it upon themselves to investigate President Trump as a traitor when he fired their friend Jim Comey in May 2017 has only served to clarify the establishment and media hostility toward President Donald J. Trump. And that was even when he was a candidate, because they obviously favored Hillary Clinton and thought she had it in the bag. With no evidence save time absurd and unsubstantiated opposition research paid for by the Clinton campaign and the Democrats, the Obama-era FBI officials decided to covertly investigate the newly elected president for treason. This inquisition was apparently in addition to the counterintelligence investigation over supposed and undefined collusion between Trump's campaign and Russia. I want to interject here that this took away from Uranium One, this inquisition of impeachment. Well, they accused him of being a foreign spy for Russia and built it up in the media because he made some favorable words about President Putin. They totally ignore the fact that Hillary Rodham Clinton sold 20% of our U.S. taxpayer-funded government uranium without authorization, it appears, to a foreign enemy nation of Russia, to Vladimir Putin. Now, I would think that would be more serious than an accusation of President Trump being a foreign agent because he had some kind words for Vladimir Putin and Russia, which is diplomacy. And I read that the alleged amount was $146,500,000, but I can't confirm that, but that is what I read and is alleged to have been paid to Hillary's Clinton Foundation. That money actually should belong to the American taxpayers and the Comey FBI and the Department of Justice, in my opinion, should have confiscated the money and returned it to the taxpayers, despite the fact that they overlooked that she sold uranium to Russia, Putin. Right after Obama said in 2012 that he would be more flexible after the 2012 elections. Which is more serious? Let's see. Let's put it on a scale of justice. Consider the FBI's multi-layered attack on Trump compared to its treatment of Senator Feinstein after officials discovered that her driver and San Francisco office director, her San Francisco office director of 20 years, had been spying for the Chinese government. So, with no evidence, save some absurd and unsubstantiated opposition research paid for by the Clinton campaign and the Democrats, the Obama-era FBI officials decided to covertly investigate the newly elected President Donald J. Trump for treason. That is stunning when you think about it logically. And in comparison to selling 20% of U.S. government uranium to a foreign enemy nation, Russia, and Vladimir Putin. And then we have Senator Feinstein and her husband involved with communist China for over 20 years. In 2013, when Feinstein led the Senate Intelligence Committee, FBI officials politely approached her to inform her that her staffer had been covertly sharing information with the San Francisco Chinese consulate, which Feinstein helped open when she was the mayor, for roughly 10 years. Feinstein was briefed. She apparently allowed the man to retire. No charges of espionage or acting as an unregistered foreign agent were ever brought against him. But the Democrats accused President Trump based on words that were favorable to Putin and Russia as a foreign agent. This is stunning when you really, really, truly logically think about what has happened here. The article says he wasn't placed in solitary confinement. He wasn't threatened with prosecution unless he cooperated with special investigators. Presumably, American taxpayers were required to pay for the Chinese spy's retirement along with those 25 years of wages for which the Chinese government was undoubtedly grateful. So we don't know what government secrets he had for 25 years that helped out the Chinese government, do we? We don't know what Huma Abedin shared on her computer with possibly her family, who are members of the Muslim Brotherhood, who are anti-American organization tied to Hamas and Hezbollah terrorist organizations. Stated and strategic, written and stated strategic goals are to wipe out all of Western civilization and dominate the world. Why are these people here in our country? Socialists, communists, Muslim Brotherhood members. Why are they here? Why are they infiltrated into our government? Why are they hired by the Democrats? Why were the Awan brothers hired by the Democrats, who were hacking into the Democrats' computers? How do you know Huma didn't share those 650,000 emails because the Comey Clinton FBI didn't care? That's for darn sure. And she allegedly lied to the FBI twice. And yet they went after General Flynn and they went after Roger Stone. But not Huma Abedin, Cheryl Mills, or the IT guy who got immunity from former director of the FBI, Comey. So anyway, indeed, there was no investigation into Feinstein colluding with China at all, despite that she is widely regarded as a China dove, that's in quotes, in the Senate, and that her husband has made millions in Chinese business dealings while she has served as a top Democrat in intelligence, energy, and foreign affairs. So this is very interesting, since Omar sits on the Committee of Foreign Affairs, and she is sympathetic to terrorists, and she and Rashida Tlaib speak at secret meetings held by the Anti-American Muslim Brotherhood, CARE meetings, where only their own are allowed in. And she is supposed to be representing Americans, not Palestine, not terrorists, not jihadists, not only Muslims, but Americans. This is all very, very bizarre, because I'm a natural born American. I grew up in this country. I've never seen anything like this in my entire life. And I find it very scary, and I find it very disturbing. And you should too. So anyway, additionally, the event wasn't reported by any media for 5 years, which meant the FBI didn't feel the need to leak it. Even when this security breach was reported, it was only mentioned in passing by Politico magazine in a story about broad Chinese espionage in Silicon Valley. Once the story broke, the San Francisco Chronicle picked it up as a local story, but it was ignored by the rest of the mainstream media, the establishment media. Now Feinstein has said, and many in media have reported, that this staffer was of no importance. He didn't know anything. And posed no threat to our national security. Oh, well, we'll just take her word for it. As a former congressional leader, I can tell you that is complete baloney, the article goes on to say. The drivers in congressional offices have near complete access to their members' schedules. They know who you are meeting with, when you are meeting with them, and sometimes a notion of what the meeting is about. I also read that Feinstein and her husband traveled to communist China secretly quite a few times, but that was alleged in several articles. They hear every conversation you have while you are being driven about from place to place, both on the phone and with staffers riding with you. Well, they certainly heard President Trump's phone call with the Ukraine, and people who weren't even on the phone call decided they would come forward and file a complaint because of gossip and hearsay. That was all based on gossip and hearsay. Anyway, it says they have access to anything you leave in the car for safekeeping. Think briefcases, notes, laptops, iPads, cell phones, etc. Furthermore, as a member of your team, they have access to the rest of your staff. The amount of intelligence a spy embedded in a congressional office could ascertain from simply attending a staff happy hour is astounding. Even if the staff member had no access to classified information, the political and policy intelligence to which he had access may have put our country at huge disadvantage in negotiating or competing with communist China. And I just read recently that communist China and Iran are allegedly, but they didn't say allegedly, I'm saying allegedly, building more nukes. That was in a Russian newspaper. These two cases clearly show the bias held by both the media and the Washington establishment. When well-entrenched Democrats find themselves enmeshed in espionage by our greatest competitor, they are briefed and the problem is ignored. They should never be our competitor. We should always be the number one superpower if we are to remain safe and sovereign in the world. Because we have many, many enemies. Many. And they're even in our country, infiltrated into our government. When the vaguest of allegations is made against a Republican or any real change agent in Washington, the establishment and media may go to war against them. Your friend, Newt Gingrich. Well, thank you, Newt Gingrich, for this article that is hopefully going to provide provocative thinking for many people to think outside of the box of what is actually going on inside our federal government for the past 25 to 40 years. Slowly, surely, consistently, persistently, well, the masses don't notice what is actually happening. So read the article, Will We Ever Know What the Chinese Learned from the Senator, by Newt Gingrich. And be aware of what is happening in your country. And on that note, we're going to take a break, and then we're going to enter into the world of authors and experts. So stay with the Rose.
Howdy, folks. Just stopped in by my favorite restaurant, the Horseshoe Cafe. I highly recommend the home-cooked hot meals and piping hot coffee. In fact, it reminds me of my mom's home cooking when I was growing up. The customer service is excellent. Be sure to save room for the world's best desserts. Make sure you try a slice of fresh homemade pie. The Horseshoe Cafe is located at 154 East 4th Street in the heart of Benson, Arizona. The Horseshoe Cafe is right outside of Tombstone, Sierra Vista, and Tucson. Sometimes Patty and Mike stop by to welcome you. The staff at the Horseshoe Cafe looks forward to seeing you. Stop by to eat or relax. Cool down in the desert with a cold beer or your favorite cocktail. That's the Horseshoe Cafe. Oh, and don't tell anyone I told you, but some people think it's haunted. One thing is for sure. Be sure to bring your appetite.
Columbo Chronicles Live. Columbo is on their trail. Listen up at Columbo Chronicles Live.
Hi, everyone. Listen up, because we're about to enter into the world of authors and experts. And we have a fabulous returning guest. His name, as you probably know him, is Preston Rendell. He is a three-time award-winning writer, and he has written for fitness magazines for the last 20 years. The magazines include Music Make, International, Planet Muscle, and Natural Physique. His subjects include training, nutritional historical subjects, interviews, and humorous articles. He actually took 2 years off to write his current novel, the one we will be talking about today, and a little bit about his other book as well, Room Full of Killers, which is his latest novel. And his first book was Health Nuts, that's N-U-T-Z, Health Nuts on Cape Cod. In 1964, he owned and operated the third health club in Massachusetts called the President City Health Club in Quincy, and the second health club on Cape Cod called Preston's Health Spa in Hyannis, Massachusetts. Along the way, he won Mr. USA Natural and in Kansas City and placed second in Mr. Universe Natural in Las Vegas. You can look him up on his website at PrestonsHealthSpa.net. In fact, Preston Rendell is a strong advocate for steroid-free sports and would like to think he was a catalyst in the fitness health boom in Massachusetts, and I'm sure he was. So let's say hello to Preston Rendell and welcome him back to Colombo Chronicles Live. Hi, Preston. How are you doing today?
Hi, what an intro. Great intro.
Well, you deserve it.
I guess.
So, what's happening out there on Cape Cod?
It's cold. It's cold and foggy.
Very really?
Foggy. Yeah, the sea fog came in. It's something or other. It's very, the vision is terrible. Last night, I couldn't see 10 feet out of my window. It was so heavy.
Really?
Yeah.
So what is the best months to visit in Cape Cod?
Oh, anytime in the spring and summer, even in early
spring
fall.
And summer. Oh, cool.
Yeah.
I've never been there, but I heard it's beautiful along with Boston and Martha's Vineyard.
Yeah, I don't think there's a better place to be in the summer, personally, you know. Could be up in Bar Harbor is amazing. Bar Harbor, Maine is an excellent place to visit, but on the whole, I think Cape in the summer is the best. You know, there's so much to do here. There's so much to do. I've been here for 25 years, and I haven't done it all yet.
Well, that's good to know, because when you go on vacation, you know, you like to have things to do, you know, and places to go and things to see.
It should be two of me. It should be two of me to get it done. You know?
Well, today, you know, we were going to talk about your novel, your latest novel, which is Room Full of Killers, which is a thriller, and also a love story, and there's fun and food and family involved. And, you know, you grew up, I believe, in the north end of Boston in an Italian neighborhood. And what was it like growing up there as a kid?
Well, actually, I grew up in the suburbs, and then I moved into the north end to be close to the boxing gym. And then got involved in all the incredible restaurants in the north end. It's all Italian. When I was in the 60s, when I was in there, you had to be Italian to move there. It was really hardcore. Oh, yeah, it was. They wouldn't let any ethnic people walk through the place. You know?
Wow, that's interesting, because my grandmother and grandfather, they lived in an Italian neighborhood, too, over near South Pasadena. And, Yeah, everybody sat out on the front porches. I remember that, and Grandma crocheted, and they'd all yell at each other back and forth.
Exactly. It was on the piazza. Right? Crocheting.
Yeah.
Rocking and crocheting.
Crocheting, yeah. Rocking chair and crocheting. That's how I remember her, you know? And so as a child, I don't think a lot of people know this, that you were not very healthy, and I wanted to mention that because you wrote the book Health Nuts on Cape Cod as well. And why don't you tell us a little bit about your family background and your health?
Okay, I was brought up by an Italian mother, and her mother lived with us as well, and my father and my brother. And my grandmother and mother were the funniest people I ever knew. And it was always a fun time to be around, laughing, and the food was unbelievable. And just one, and my mother played the piano and sang. And her brother, for the older listeners, her brother sang with Charlie Barnett in the 40s, which was a very big band. It was one of the top 10 big bands of the 40s. And
wow.
Charlie Barnett, his wife made him leave because women were after him.
Oh.
My Uncle John was no looker, believe me, but his wife, what the heck was her name? Eleanor, she made him leave the band. And you know who went in the band? Merv Griffin.
Oh, my gosh.
Yep.
That is quite a story.
Yeah.
I
thought you liked
that's
that.
That's a good story. I do like that.
Yeah. And my mother played the piano, sang. My father played the trombone for his whole life, but he was actually an engineer. But he had aspirations of, you know, he played with Glenn Miller one time. And Miller made him an offer to join the band. And of course, that means traveling all over the country and this and that. But he was married with two kids. He couldn't do that, you know. So my father became involved in music. He was president of the Musicians Union in Framingham for 25 years. They had a huge testimonial dinner for him when he retired. It was hosted by, who's that guy? What's his name? Oh boy! And then his name, the guy that was a show singer. I bartended in Ken Steakhouse in Framingham. He used to come in every day and drink. I should know his name. I remember what he drank. He drank a shot of bourbon and a bottle of early Miller High Life. That's what he drank.
You remember what he drank?
Gordon McRae.
That's funny.
Gordon McRae hosted. You remember that name?
Yeah.
I'm sure. He hosted my father's testimonial, which was at the Monte Cellar, which was the biggest nightclub in New England and even New York. It was a big, big affair, you know. And anyway, that's where I was brought up. All of the people who sang at the Monte Cellar had to go through my father to get there, you know, because it was a union house. And I met everybody in show business, I think, except Sinatra. It was huge. I could go backstage and meet him, stay in the dressing room, talk with him. It was unbelievable. But
that's
what I was. Yeah, I played the trumpet when I was a kid. I didn't get really crazy about the instrument. And then I switched to guitar when I was late teens, and. My brother played the piano a bit, but my mother played the piano every day of the week and sang every day. On Sundays, we're all woken up to Chopin. Every Sunday, she played Chopin.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, yeah, it was amazing.
Yeah, it's amazing. And yeah.
My grandmother, all I see here is with an apron on cooking.
Yeah, that was my grandmother, too. Just always had the apron on and cooking and cleaning and cooking and cleaning. And she was happy because the family was together. That was it, you know. Different times, huh?
Yeah.
I mean, what a great way to grow up, though. I mean, you know, with that environment. You know, that's the best years of my life, remembering my grandmother in the kitchen like you.
Yeah. My grandma was something.
Well, I played the accordion. My uncle played the accordion, so you're just reminding me of my family,
you
know,
say you
growing up. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Huh. That's how Connie Francis started.
Oh, really?
Playing the accordion and singing the weddings.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah.
She was such a cutie. Beautiful voice. So, but then you weren't very healthy as a kid, right?
No. Not at all. I got asthma. I don't know where it came from. Nobody knows because nobody in the family ever had it. Nobody. And I was brought to specialists everywhere. And they couldn't just say it was asthma. That's all, you know. And from the time I was about 6 till I was about, had to be 12, 13, I was in and out of oxygen tents in my house. You know, I was laid up in an oxygen tent. And, I couldn't run and play like I could run, but then if I overextended myself, which boys at that age tend to do, you get an attack of asthma.
Right.
You know, and but that all changed when I was introduced to weightlifting. I'm convinced that's what took it out of my system.
How did you get introduced to weightlifting?
Well, it was kind of a slow process. I saw a couple of muscular kids around town and figuring out what was going on. Then I found a magazine with a course in the back. It said you can train yourself from this to this if you start working out. So this was in I can tell you exactly when. March 26, 1957. I got my bodybuilding course delivered to my house. And that's what I say. That's my alternative date of birth, because that's when I was born. Everything changed. My whole entire life changed. Everything. You know, I was
wow.
I wasn't a 97-pound weakling. I was a 77-pound weakling.
Wow.
And I put on the first year. I think I put on 50 pounds.
Really?
And I was hooked. Hooked. I still am. You know, it's an excellent thing to do for a boy, you know. The discipline is unbelievable, you know, and it stays with you with everything you do, the discipline, you know. I like to think I'm a very incredibly disciplined person. When I wrote the book, A Room Full of Killers, I wrote 6 to 8 hours a day for 2.5 hours, and I didn't take one day off. Imagine that.
Wow. Yeah,
that's
people don't realize. That is really cool. And you know, I think, too, though, when you get involved in something you love, whether it's weightlifting or playing an instrument or writing a book, if you have passion and love for it, I think you get involved in the characters and the story, and you become part of it, right?
Absolutely. I wouldn't have taken a day off if you paid me, because I was right into the story in it, and I had the next page written in my head before I even put it down. It was unbelievable. And I didn't have an outline or anything. I just sat down and wrote.
Well, sometimes
crazy.
That's the best
but
way.
It was,
it's coming. It's flowing,
it
right? The
much,
energy's flowing.
Yeah, it was pretty much my life story. Living in the North End. And when I moved in there, to be closer to the gym, there's a mob war going on, you know? Then all the food and the, I just wrote my life story. I just looked at my life story and wrote it down. Then the weekends I go home to my grandmother and mother in Manjatuta, you know?
So you wrote it as a fictional story, but it's actually based on a true story, right?
Oh, yeah. It's like 90% true.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so let's get into A Room Full of Killers, because Room Full of Killers is an extremely unique, powerful novel of many elements, and it includes thrilling excitement, boxing, love, laughter, fun, sad, bad, good times, and family. So it's really a great combination and make a great movie. And so who are your main characters in your book? What are their names, and who are your main characters, and how does your book begin?
Okay, first of all, let me tell you what this is. I'm trying to get an agent now, and I might have one, I'm not sure, to push for a movie. I call it what's that, a Swedish movie called I Remember Mama meets Raging Bull without the jail time. That's exactly what it is. It's my Italian family, which I was with on weekends, which was fun. They said they're not in Boston in the boxing game, which is just nothing but crooked and a cop mob. Oh, jeez. Guess what it was, you know? And I got involved because the Clay, well, he was Cassius Clay then, and Muhammad Ali, he was fighting Sonny Liston in a rematch in Boston. And Sonny Liston was training in the Plymouth White Cliffs, which is a very, very classy resort on the ocean. He was training there, Sonny Liston. So he could go watch him. So I went and I watched him. That's how my book starts out. I go and watch Sonny Liston and train. And the story is just unbelievable. He's like he was a superhuman. The only way I can describe him. A very different kind of human being is the only way to describe him. And of athletic abilities. And they were, was free, you know. Oh, no, it was $2 a head to get in. That's what it was. And the place was packed. So then the next day I went to see Cassius Clay train in Boston. And he was for free. So I went there. I don't think there was 20 people in place. I said, wait a minute, he's a champion. Has he got 20 people to you? Sonny Liston is down in Plymouth. The place is mobbed. So anyway, I stood right up against the ring. I could have talked to him while he was training. I couldn't believe it, you know. So anyway, I saw them both, and at that time I was like, I'm 6 feet. I was about 215, maybe 20. I said, these guys can't be stronger than me because I was bodybuilding, you know. And I said, I was a very good athlete in high school. I ran 100, and I threw the shot put for 4 years, and I never lost once. So I knew I was as strong as these guys. I'm fast, so I'll give it a shot, you know. I'm only in it for the money. I'm not in there to get better looking, you know. You know, get in and get out. So then I matriculated, I guess the word is, into amateur boxing, and the story starts from there. You know, all the crooked stuff that went on, even on an amateur level. You know, jeez.
Yeah, you also said, you know, that you were asked a lot in the book. You know, you're asked a lot. You know, what is it like when you keep getting hit over and over and you get knocked down? And you call it a pain game and similar to a game of chess. Is that how it felt when you were boxing?
Yep. Yep. It's an absolute pain game. There's no question about that. But what it is, it's, you know, if you understand that boxing evolved from fencing, that's how it is. There's this stance, the whole thing. And if you know fencing, they do fakes, they parry. They move. They do things to move the guy out of the place so they can strike him. That's the same thing with boxing. You know, but you do it with your fist, not with a sword or a lance or whatever they call them. But that's what it is. It's a real mental chess game. You know, elite levels anyway.
And then when you got involved in boxing, how did you get your first opportunity?
Well, my first fight, I had a good friend of mine named Billy Conticelli. He came in and he seconded me. You know, the guy is the second. He's the guy that comes in and gives you the water and stuff between rounds. We just went to a place in Boston called the Boston Arena Annex. Now you gotta be either crazy or a big set of stones. You just go in there and you sign your name up, and they match you with somebody. You don't know who you're fighting.
I said
to Billy, I said, I don't care if this guy's 10 feet tall and breathing fire, I'm going to knock him out. That's the way you got to think.
So what happened? Did you do that? Did you knock him out?
No, I knocked him down in the second round. And so there were only three rounds, and I won the decision. But I found out from my cousins, who were from Uxbridge, Mass, they were all talented, every one of them. And one of them called me the next day, and he said, your fight was on the late news. I said, my fight? What was that on fight? He said, you won the fight of the night. I said, oh, I didn't know that. And they put it on the sports thing in Boston News. I wish I had a film of that. But that's, you know, that's how I started. And then they had another fight. And then they tried. Another story it's in my book. A guy in the gym wanted me to box an exhibition in the suburb of Boston outside in the afternoon. With a fighter he'd been training, and it's just going to be an exhibition. I said okay. I went down, and my father went down. My brother went down. And we we went in and boxed this guy. Now, this guy that told me he was setting up, the guy that lulled me into this, worked my corner. Do you understand what that means? Okay, the first round, I knocked this guy down. Well, it was supposed to be an exhibition. This guy came out like a hurricane. He's throwing atom bombs at me. I said, what the hell is this? I saw him. I said, hey, this is an exhibition. What are you doing? Nothing. He just kept firing. And I said, holy, I can't believe this. It's supposed to be an exhibition. So the second round, I think it was the second round. Yeah, the second round, I hit him with a shot and he went down. No, it was the first round. I hit him with a shot and he went down. And it was right at the end of the round, he got up and staggered to his corner. Okay, now I go back to my corner, and the guy that was training me isn't out of my corner. I said, what the hell? Now there's another guy, Carmine. I don't forget his name, Carmine. He's like 5 feet five, a little Italian guy. Yeah, okay, how you doing? Yeah, I said, where's Paul? Paul Stivaletta, that was the guy that was training me. And he said, he didn't say anything. He said, just take it easy, kid. We got another round. So I did three rounds. The same stuff was happening. The guy was trying to hit me on the break, and he was doing everything dirty you can imagine. And I hurt the guy bad in the third round, and I almost had him out, but then the thing ended. Now, there's no judges, and there's no, you know, because it's supposed to be an exhibition. So now it's over. So I leave, and my father and my brother come over to me. My father was ripped mad. He said, when you knocked that guy down in the first round, he went immediately over to the other guy's corner and worked his corner. I said, what? He said, yeah, they were setting you up because this kid has and there was all kinds of news people there from the Boston Globe with cameras and such. What the hell is this all about, you know?
Mm-hmm.
They were going to, this guy, I was undefeated at that stage. I didn't have that many fights, but I was undefeated. And this guy supposedly had 5, 6, 7 fights. My father said, this kid has a 24-2 record, which is a world of difference from a guy with like 5 or 6 fights, you know? So he stuck me in with this kid, and this guy was supposed to knock me out. The Boston Globe people were supposed to film it, and they were going to get a big spread in the sports page because the kid was going to turn pro in another month. So they're setting me up for the kill, but it didn't work.
Oh.
the referee for that fight was a guy named Paul Penda, who was a middleweight champion of the world. And he beat Sugar Ray Robinson twice in decisions in Boston and won the middleweight title. He said to me after the fight, when you turn pro, he said, I want to train you. I said, holy mackerel, I don't believe this, Paul Penta. So I talked to my father afterwards, and we said, we'll make that decision when we come to it, you know. But anyway, that was the first dirty thing that happened to me, you know. I said, what a dirty trick. They tried to stick me right to the wolves. Wow.
So
who would have thought?
Who would have thought, right? And
yeah.
So did you meet other people that were, like mob type of people while you were boxing, and did it get really crazy?
People. Yeah, you could say that. You could say that. Do the Chinese eat rice? That's all you can say, is all it is mob people, you know?
So do you have a story that stands out in your mind about something that you could tell us about?
Let me think. Well, it was a guy from, I got a ton of stories. I don't know which one's better than the other. But one guy named Irish Al Kivlin, K-I-V-L-A-M, he's from Cambridge, Mass. He's a pretty good fighter. He didn't do business with a promoter in Boston, who was named Subway Sam Silverman. That's what they call him, Subway Sam, who was as crooked as a corkscrew. He was supposed to throw a fight or something for Subway Sam, and he didn't. And he beat the guy, you know, because he was a straight fighter. So the next fight he had was in the Boston Arena, and which is one step lower than the Boston Garden. And he had a fight in there, and he got demolished in the first round by a guy that was was supposed to have just an average record, but the guy was from New York City. He had like a 30-0 record and was a killer. He stuck him on Al Kaler and knocked him out in one round.
Oh, my gosh.
There's guys that I know that fought for Sam Silverman, and most of the guys never even got. This is why I got out of boxing. The promoters and the managers get rich, and you get broke. You know. He would pay you $25 for a four-round fight. Now, who the hell would fight someone for $25, right? After you have 20 to 30 fights, he will move you up to a 10-round main event, okay, which is, you know, the main event. He will give you $100. Isn't that wonderful?
To get knocked around,
I said, I may be dumb, but I'm not stupid. Jeez.
So the people that really make the money then are probably like the agents?
The managers, the trainers, and promoters. Not the trainers, the managers and the promoters.
They get the big bucks?
Yeah, okay, here's a good story. Mike Tyson got knocked out in the biggest upset in boxing history by a guy whose name kind of escapes me now. What the hell is his name? James Buster Douglas. He fought him in Tokyo. He fought Tyson in Tokyo, and the take was like, James Buster Douglas was fighting Tyson, who was a champion. James Buster Douglas's take for the fight was supposed to be $20 million. And that's what you read in the newspaper. He's got $20 million. Holy mackerel. Right. That's what hooked me when I saw Clay and Liston. I said, they're fighting in Boston. They're going to get $1 million each. I said, that's for me. You know. Then you find out it's not quite like that. James Buster Douglas is supposed to get $20 million for that fight. And after he was managed by King, or the Don King, and the promoter. Don King was a promoter. Okay. After deductions, and it was a list of about 10 different deductions, James Buster Douglas got $90,000.
Wow.
Imagine that.
Wow. That's, oh, my gosh. Nobody even knows this.
Imagine?
I mean, you know, they just say you're going to get $20 million, and everybody thinks, wow, you know. But it's not like that in reality.
Then they charge James Buster Douglas for staying in a hotel over there for a week, and they said for flying over for food, blah blah blah. They got accounts that just rob you to death. You know, he got $90,000.
Wow.
And $20 million. Imagine.
Well, I can imagine that. You know, I can imagine how horrible it is, but I can also imagine how easily they could take advantage of people, too.
Oh,
you
yeah.
Know, who,
well,
you
let's
know.
Put this way. Back then, I don't know about now, but most of the fighters come out of, you know, slums and poverty, and except for Gene Tunney was a brilliant guy. But, like, Dempsey was a hobo, Jack Dempsey. And most of them came from that. Of course, Joe Louis was not a Rhodes Scholar, but he was the best fighter ever lived. And accountants and accounting and money, and this is not their forte, you know. And you get a manager to watch out for you, and he's as big a crook as them.
I know, it's really like you really have to watch your own money, because if you hand it over to somebody else, you probably won't see it again.
What kind of happens? You hear about it in show business all the time. This woman, they declare bankruptcy because some accounting firm or lawyers or whatever robbed them to death, and they wound up blank money. You know, and they lost $20 million. They didn't know where it went. You know, it happens all the time. Wayne
happens
Newton,
all the time. Oh, yeah,
yeah,
Wayne
does.
Newton. Yeah, it happens all the time.
Vultures out there. So it is vultures.
Yeah. And so in your book, Room Full of Killers, you also fall in love, right? How did you meet the love of your life?
Yeah, I have a white heat love affair. I met a girl in the Regina Pizza, which is probably the best pizza place in Boston, as far as I'm concerned. That's in the book. The whole story is right in the book. And all the waitresses, the two bartenders, the owner of the Regina Pizza, and the manager are all named after my cats. Oh, yeah. The lead character, the boxer, is named Gianni Valentino Romasco. Now, why Valentino? Valentino, my grandmother's husband died in the early 30s, and she brought up four kids during the Depression with no welfare, right? So she said to me one time, she said she would, never would remarry, but she said the only one she would have remarried would have been Rudolph Valentino.
Yeah, and I know you also said she wore black, too, after your grandfather died.
She wore black. It's 40, 50 years later. She still wore black.
Isn't that amazing?
Her and my grandmother and her sister, my grandmother was Nina and her sister was Angelina. They came over here from Italy on a boat with their money sewed in their skirts to marry two brothers sight unseen. Imagine that?
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah, my grandmother had four. Go ahead.
And so, did you have? Were you ever threatened by the mafia or anything like that, or not?
No. I didn't get that high up to get involved. You know, in the book, I go all the way to the top, but I know what was going on enough to put it down on paper. But no, I didn't. And that time when I got shafted by the guy in the supposed exhibition, we just didn't talk again. I saw him at the gym, you know, after that a lot. I was friends with him up till then, you know, and that happened. I said, that's it with him. Sure. I never spoke to him again. And he didn't approach me because he knew I was upset. And so then I met another guy who's in the book and trained me, and who was a, should be a whole book about him. Jesus. This guy was a Canadian Cree Indian.
Wow.
And he was six. He was 6 feet three, about 15 or 20. He didn't have an ounce of fat in his body, and he didn't watch his weight. He didn't bodybuild or nothing. He was just heaped in muscle. Oh, jeez.
Wow.
He was a freak of nature, like Sonny Liston. You know, some people are born like that. You know, full-blown mesomorphs. They don't do anything, and they're muscular, you know.
Right.
Ecto, and mesomorph. He was a mesomorph, and the stories about him, I could tell you, you just wouldn't believe.
Oh, we'll have to do that again. So.
Yeah, the story.
Yeah, and you have great stories. I love your stories. And so you not only wrote Room Full of Killers and also Health Nuts on Cape Cod. You eventually opened up three gyms, and so do you still run and operate gyms? And
I sold them all. I had the first. Actually, it was the first health club in Massachusetts in Quincy. The only other one was the YMCA in Boston. Was the only one that had weights, and that was like a maybe 10 by 10 room in the basement of the YMCA with no windows, with some weights strewn on the floor and hadn't been cleaned since the Taft administration. That was the only place to work out. So I found a location in Quincy and I opened up. I went to town hall and told the woman behind the counter, I remember like it happened yesterday, what I was going to do, and I wanted a permit to open a. And she laughed at me. This was in 64. And she said, people are going to pay you money to go inside a building and exercise. I said, yeah, right. So she called. This is a true story. She called her girlfriend over on the desk. You know, come here, Susan, or whatever. She said, tell her that. You won't believe this story. So I told her. They both laughed. She said, yeah, here's your permit. So I opened up my club, and it exploded business-wise.
Wow. So good things came out of all of it, and you know, I mean, seriously, you became a successful entrepreneur, businessman, training people, teaching people about health, you became a health expert. And so before we close our interview, I wanted to ask you, because everybody's concerned about the coronavirus, and you are a health expert, how would you suggest to people how to keep themselves healthy and during this period of time until this hopefully fades away?
Yeah, okay. Here's my advice, and this comes from like 50 years of being in the health business. Incidentally, now I'm into the natural healing business. I've done a lot of natural healings. And,
oh, well, let's talk about that.
Yeah, I could, five people with cancer in the last 2 years. I don't know if I can say it on the radio.
We'll have to do another radio show on that one, because I'm totally into natural.
I got a one-hour cure for shingles. I got a one-hour cure for shingles.
Oh, wow.
1 hour.
Wow.
Yep, works. Oh, anyway, here's the thing to do. First of all, I wouldn't get a vaccination. They're pushing vaccinations now for the virus. That's completely hogwash, you know. It's in the paper. I got it here right in front of me. I cut it out today. It says the first batch of a possible coronavirus vaccine, possible, which means they're using you as a guinea pig. Early stage testing. You know what that means? You're a guinea pig.
Yes, you're a guinea pig. Right.
Yeah,
I agree.
I wouldn't recommend any vaccines, especially kids. The children, they're messing up.
They're
going to
put
anyway,
coronavirus
thing,
in your body. Great.
Yeah. The other thing is try to stay away from crowds if you can, you know. And even church, you know, you don't need to sit in there with 50 people coughing, you know. Supermarkets, you know, you got to be very careful about that. Now, wash your hands frequently. I would really stay away from anything products made in China. And there's a lot of food that's made in China.
Oh, yeah. You need to read those labels.
Yeah. And now I read a thing on the computer that says they don't have to list it anymore. That's how they get away with that. But here's the other. This is my thing. Okay, you get a cup of hot water. Put a heaping tablespoon of raw honey in it. Then put in you can break open a turmeric capsule, and put it in that as well and stir it. Nobody understands how, why, or what, but the two together work as some kind of catalyst, whatever, and they destroy any pathogens in your body. Imagine that.
That's fantastic to know, and I appreciate that, because
turmeric,
I think
honey
that, you
and
know,
hot water.
The government isn't going to give information on natural ways to protect yourself. And they're going to only tell you to go get a vaccination or go to a hospital room where there's tons of people that you can contact.
Everybody's,
you know, the same thing. Yeah.
Oh, but I
guess, gee, Preston Rendell, this really went quickly, like always, and I always enjoy talking to you. And
me too.
Your room full of killers, tell us how they can purchase your book and any message you want to give to them and your website.
I got a website, PrestonsHealthSpa.net, but my book is available on Amazon. I have rave reviews.
Oh, yeah, it's a page turner.
Yeah, one woman from New Jersey, Eileen Zuccato, she said she read the book, the book has 535 pages. It's a big book. I just couldn't stop. I edited down from, it was over for 700, and I edited it down to 535. She said she couldn't put it down. She said she read the book when she was changing her grandson. She read the book when she was cooking dinner. She read the book when she was doing the laundry. She said, I read the book in 5 days. She said, I'm a voracious reader. She said, it's the best fiction book I've ever read in my life. I almost fainted when I read the review.
Well, congratulations on everything you're doing and everything you've done. And, you know, everything you do is helping people. And I think that is so important, not just about making money, but also helping other people and entertaining
Absolutely.
Them with your true story, in fact. And so I hope everyone goes out and gets Room Full of Killers and also checks out House Nets on Cape Cod. No, you won't be sorry. And it's on Amazon.com. Thank you, and God bless you, Preston, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Well, thanks for having me on. It was my pleasure. Thanks again.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Have a good
Preston Rendell has left the building, and we have run out of time. But I just want to say God bless you. And like Preston says, stay away from crowds if you can, and use a lot of either Clorox or hydrogen peroxide at 70% to clean your hands and wash your hands frequently. And even with the carts at the markets, you should also take those little wipes and be sure you're wiping those off and wiping your hands off. In my opinion, these are some of the suggestions. And as he said, a glass of warm water with turmeric capsule and just empty it out. And some honey, and you're going to help protect yourself the best you can. So God bless you. God bless America. We'll have another wonderful guest next Wednesday from 12 to 1 p.m. live. Share and bookmark Colombo Chronicles Live. God bless you. God bless America.
Rose Colombo is signing off, and she's left the building. Be sure to bookmark and share Colombo Chronicles Live every Wednesday from 8 to 9 p.m. on the West Coast. Or if you're sleepless in the big city, that would be 11 to midnight on the East Coast. Rose Colombo says, remember, you're never alone when you tune in every Wednesday to Colombo Chronicles.